This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. All right, this week I went to a lecture a while back called Solidarity with Children back in November with author Madeline Lane McKinney, sponsored by the Rohr Center and the U of O Gender Studies. And so it's a bit dry. But and also that people brought their kids, so I tried to lower the kids screaming, but it's actually kind of nice to have, there's nothing like the laughter of a child. So this is about, you know, 50 minutes or over 50 minutes, and then next week is the Q&A that I'll have a little bit more to say, a little bit of my perspective on The Family Abolition Movement and Solidarity with Children by Madeline Lane McKinney. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media.
Madeline is a feminist writer, parent, and teacher based in Portland, Oregon. She's the author of Comedy Against Work, Utopian Longing in Dystopian Times, and Dear Z, the co-author of Fag Hag, and an editor of Blind Field, a journal of cultural inquiry. Her writing has appeared in publications such as the Los Angeles Review of Books, Boston Review, The New Inquiry, and Protean Magazine. And I just wanted to share a small anecdote, because Madeline today learned that she has a special place, I think, in our community here in the U of O, because when some of us allegedly were involved in the Palestine encampment here, we started a Twitter account to connect with other encampments. And because we started it while the encampment was happening, we had an algorithmic block that didn't actually let the encampment to be searchable in Twitter at the time. And the only way to break through is to actually have local engagement that helps to organically break the algorithm. And so it was very difficult to do that, but someone reached out to Madeline asking for her support in helping us to publicize our encampment in Portland. And actually that was like a key decisive help and support for it to actually break through the algorithm. And we had a lot of engagement with Portland organizers in Palestine, in solidarity with Palestine. So that is a very beautiful thing that I think you have in connection to our community. So I'm very glad that you are here again and that you get to share your work. We're going to begin by Madeline reading from the book. Then Melody and Professor Kamisha Russell and I will have a brief conversation, a brief series of questions, and then we'll open it up for you to also ask some questions. And at the end, you can acquire Madeline's book, and I'm sure she'll be happy to sign. Yeah. So, welcome to the University of Oregon. We're so glad you're here. And
thank you.
Thank you for sharing this with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you to Solo. Yeah. Such a wonderful. So, let's see. Yeah, I wanted to thank Gonzalo. There are a few people here, including this little one, who are in my dedication page that I want to thank. Yak and Ash, and of course my partner, Kyle, and my kiddo Zania, were integral to this project. I couldn't have done it without you, and I love you. I'm going to read from, I think, two excerpts from the book. The first one is kind of giving you a sense, I hope, of like the overall argument of the text. And then I thought, especially because I am here, I didn't realize that backstory, but I was following what you all were doing with the encampments. I wrote a bit about the Free Gaza encampment movement, and I'd like to share that section as well. I'd really like to hear about your experiences doing that. I found it very inspiring. All right. So this is from the introduction.
No.
At the center of this book is a claim that we live in a world that is profoundly against children. What I have described is not a hatred of children, though hatred of children is certainly an aspect of it. Even in its idealization of children, this world is against children. while it may idealize some children, it harms all children. It is a world that day by day renders their future more apocalyptic, and in which they are taught day by day that this is just inevitable. We make this hell normal, knowing that children will most likely live out something far worse, the terror of which we can only begin to recognize. Of course, most of the time, for adults who spend time with children, this reality must be kept out of the foreground. It's too painful to think about while caring for young people who need you to not be crying all the time. But this reality is everywhere. It is inescapable. It is the reality of Palestinian and Israeli children whose violent deaths are weighed against each other. The reality of children as young as 5 years old working with bare hands in the cobalt mines of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The reality of over 330 million children living in extreme poverty worldwide. The reality of the immigrant children caged at borders, of the trans children targeted by the state, of the 1 in 3 Black and Latinx households with children in the US facing food insecurity, and of the roughly 1 billion children worldwide who experience physical, sexual, or emotional violence each year. 5 days a week, the person I love the most in this world is at a public school classroom in a country where school shootings are rampant and increasing by the year. There simply aren't days when the thought doesn't hang over teachers and staff in schools, or days when children, parents, guardians, and caretakers are not constantly reminded of this possibility. In 2018, 113 people were killed or injured in school shootings in the US. On average, there was a shooting once every 8 school days that year. The worst on record, until soon it was not. That March, youth activists against gun violence organized the March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. Delaney Tarr, the activist in Parkland shooting survivor who co-founded March for Our Lives, remembers a particular slogan spread across the signs at the event: "The kids will save us." In a 2022 essay for Teen Vogue, Tarr shared her frustrations with this slogan and what she describes as the, quote, youth activist industrial complex. "The kids will save us" followed the activists for years. With each shooting, Tarr recalls feeling a sense of guilt and failure, precisely, quote, "because we were the kids, but we hadn't saved them." At the same time, she explains, nobody ever asked how are the kids supposed to save us. If children are imagined as having any agency at all in this world, they are delegated with the impossible task of saving the planet. In this effort, youth are encouraged to focus on legislative demands, doing work for votes in a system in which children have no right to vote. This was certainly the case for March for Our Lives, which itself demobilized autonomous organizing among high school students for a nationwide strike and reoriented their energy toward gun control laws. For the religious right, this world against children is most clearly illuminated by what is done in the name of children. Take the nonprofit organization Moms for Liberty, whose stated mission is to, quote, "promote liberty" and, quote, "fight for our children." The organization describes itself as dedicated to the survival of America through, quote, "unifying and educating and empowering parents to defend their parental rights at all levels of government." This notion of liberty has nothing to do with child liberation or children's rights, but takes the form of parental rights and ownership over children, as well as discrimination against minoritized children for the sake of implicitly white, gender normative, and therein innocent children. The most significant accomplishment of this group has been to mobilize book bans and curricular bans in public education on subjects such as slavery, racism, and LGBTQ. Made on behalf of, quote, "liberty-minded families and their children," these calls for school censorship are inconspicuous attacks on non-white and queer children. They have been instrumental to a broader culture of adult parent activists harassing, abusing, and endangering trans and non-binary children and their caretakers, including parents and educators. Certain stories are becoming more familiar to our times, like that of a man forcibly removed from a fourth grade track meet in Kelowna, British Columbia, where he accosted a 9-year-old and demanded proof that she was female, as his wife screamed and called the child's parents, quote, genital mutilators. Or the story of an anti-Pride Day rally held at Santa Cruz Elementary in North Hollywood, where violence erupted after more than 100 parents formed to chant anti-gay slurs as 100 or so counter-protesters formed a human chain around the school to protect LGBTQ children and families. Along with such direct attacks on children by adults, the quote, parental rights phenomenon has exacerbated bullying at school and on social media among children, worsened the learning conditions and safety of many students, and most certainly contributed to the increase of youth suicide and suicidal ideation, which has doubled in the last decade. Anti-abortion politics operate by this same logic, fetishizing the idea of the innocent child, the fetus, while failing to care for real children, while insisting that inclusive public school education is, quote, government overreach. The Christian right promotes state authoritarianism when it comes to all matters of reproductive health, exerting control over people's bodily autonomy that results in harm to both fetus and gestator. In the US, the pregnancy-related mortality has doubled over the last two decades, with Black and Indigenous women facing disproportionately high risks. But the anti-child politics of the pro-life agenda are thrown into starker relief on the topic of youth access to abortion. Adolescents are most impacted by post-Roe state restrictions and experience the most barriers to seeking safe and legal abortions, including state requirements of parental consent. Due to delays in care, youth pregnancies face greater risk of medical complications as well. In the name of children, this is violence against children. We shouldn't need to hear about the worst case scenarios, like the 10-year-old incest victim in Ohio who was forced to travel out of state for an abortion, or the 13-year-old rape victim who gave birth after being denied an abortion in Mississippi. To know that all forcible pregnancies and forcible childbirths are themselves products of sexual violence. This can and needs to be a site of shared struggle for adults and children. Recognition of the ways our struggles are shared is fundamental to building solidarity with children. As child liberationist writer Carla Joy Bergman suggests, quote, part of trusting and listening to kids is being open to what the path forward can and will look like with them. For so many adults, this may feel impossible. To think about the future at all, whether in apocalyptic, denialist, or revolutionary terms, presents a daily challenge. But these are the stakes of solidarity with children, to take collective responsibility for our future, whatever it may be. This is also a matter of following the lead of youth movements. Across calls for a free Gaza, protests against raids by ICE and police violence, demands for access to abortions and gender-affirming care, and the fight against global climate crisis, youth today are at the forefront of our most urgent political struggles. None of this is new. Whether as a talisman for hope or as a mere scapegoat for generational conflicts, the role of youth has, time and again, been overlooked or worse, overwritten. We owe it to each other to show up together in as many ways as possible. My partner told me to read further into this chapter would be kind of a bummer, so I promise it's not just a bummer, but I hope it's helpful to hear that the broader claim I'm making. I also wanted to say, like, this is a, one of my students yesterday said, happy essay launch. I was really appreciative of her attention to the genre I wrote in. So I'm gonna put on my teacher hat for a moment and remind everyone that the root of the essay is in the French essayé, which means to try. And I felt it was a formally important to think about trying and to think about child liberation as something that's actually quite unthinkable in our world, which is completely structured around adult power and supremacy. So the question of what is thinkable in terms of child liberation really animates the book in lots of ways for me. So the hope is that this provides a framework to think child liberation, to make that thinkable, to sharpen our political imagination so that we can even put that into practice in small ways. But it begins with the recognition that it is profoundly unthinkable what this looks like. So the first chapter is really thinking about Gaza, and I started writing this about a week before October 7th, actually. And thinking about the collective experience of scrolling through genocide, as Stephen Salida calls it, and specifically the way in which we are consuming so many images of violence against children. I can talk a little bit more later about why I use that verb, consuming. The second chapter is called The Idea of Children, or excuse me, it's called Dreams Called Childhood. I'm mistaking it for another text I wrote. And that's really unpacking the idea of children and its invention. And I can also talk more about that, but just to be brief, childhood isn't a natural thing. It had to be socially constructed. And tracing the history of childhood as a concept, we see very clearly that it's a product of the private family, particularly a logic of private property. Right? So the child emerges as a category of private property, and to be owned. So one of the questions that I have in thinking about this, how do we relate to children if not as owners? And I can talk more about that as well. But I have a chapter about mothering, which thinks through different political narratives of motherhood as an institution and attempts to articulate mothering as a practice of care against those institutions. And then the third chapter, which I'll read from now, is called The Trouble with School. And it's looking at school as a system of disciplining disciplining children into adulthood. I'm also, the section I'm going to be reading from is concerned with the category of a student. One of the things that I'm exploring in terms of the category of child is how many adults are rendered children. Whether that is disability, poverty, racialization, gender. But students are infantilized, as I'm sure everyone knows here. And I'm interested in the particular anxieties that we're seeing from fascists today about the figure of the student. So I'm going to read from that section. This chapter is looking before this at various attempts to politicize schooling, whether in unschooling, the kind of broader philosophy of unschooling or homeschooling. Sorry, I keep touching that. Or various kinds of social justice and radical pedagogy. I'll say before this that I am a teacher and that I have not spent any time not being a student or a teacher in my life. I'm an academic worker, I'm a super adjunct. I work at two universities. So I'll say that up front. I'm in it. I'm in schooling, and I'm thinking about teaching, as I am sure others are too. So unschooling, homeschooling, or various forms of social justice and radical pedagogy will never be enough to take on the trouble with school in its totality. As individual parents, caretakers, and teachers, we have to develop ways of collectivizing these practices. The struggle needs to extend outside of households and classrooms and towards a broader project of liberation. This would involve a revolution of de-schooling, what Austrian philosopher Ivan Illich elaborated as a social transformation based in the disestablishment of the school system. In his 1971 treatise, De-Schooling Society, Illich envisioned the conditions for a liberation movement that starts in school, which, quote, could foreshadow the revolutionary strategies of the future. This educational revolution would be guided by the following goals. One, to liberate access to things by abolishing the control which persons and institutions now exercise over their educational values. Two, to liberate the sharing of skills by guaranteeing freedom to teach or exercise them on request. Three, to liberate the critical and creative resources of people by returning to individual persons the ability to call and hold meetings, an ability now increasingly monopolized by institutions which claim to speak for people. Four, to liberate the individual from the obligation to shape his expectations to the services offered by any established profession, but providing him with the opportunity to draw on the experience of his peers and to entrust himself to the teacher, guide, advisor, or healer of his choice. Inevitably, the de-schooling of society will blur the distinctions between economics, education, and politics on which the stability of the present world order and the stability of nations now rest. As opposed to models based on as opposed to models based on de-schooling is directed towards a communization of education and critical thinking, which is necessarily intergenerational as well. It begins with the recognition that schooling isn't just for children. We are all involved in schooling, as Illich writes, from both the side of production and that of consumption. Schooling is our social totality. It is everywhere, and it is inescapable. There are no individual solutions to this predicament. Indeed, it is necessarily understood in collective terms of collective struggle. In this regard, Illich's initial conception of de-schooling should be recovered from the free market solutions to the school system proposed in his 1973 follow-up, After De-Schooling, What? This is a matter of discerning the process from the program of his work. Regarding revolutionary strategy, he provides an essential insight. Quote, the risks of a revolt against school are unforeseeable, he acknowledges. But they are not as horrible as those of a revolution starting in any other major institution, since school is not yet organized for self-protection as effectively as a nation-state or even a large corporation. With the increasing privatization of universities, however, this will continue to be less and less the case. The Gaza Solidarity Encampment emerged as a powerful form of de-schooling and solidarity as I began writing this book. Students were creating Gaza solidarity encampments in universities across the world, calling for an end to the Palestinian genocide and demanding institutional and governmental divestment from Israel. Perhaps more, nowhere more than in schools, are the political contradictions of this moment so clear as we watch institutions of critical thinking systematically retaliate against students and teachers who actually engage in critical thought. At Columbia University, students who have taken courses such as genocide studies collectively decided to put their education into practice. But this is exactly the line at which schooling asserts its control. It is what distinguishes between matters of free speech and campus safety. Those are in scare quotes. What's most dangerous about campus is what can be called dangerous. And in this scheme, mass arrests and police violence against students and teachers do not count. Today, we are seeing the acceleration of what cultural critic Samuel Catlin calls campus panic. It is not a new phenomenon. Quote, from Vietnam to Gaza, it has never let up, reliably every few months something happens on campus that the media inflates to the status of a national emergency, which are circulated as scandals so fascinating and disturbing that they eclipse even a genocide. By resisting the fantasy of the campus, he suggests, we can also begin to resist this campus panic. Quote, the Gaza Solidarity encampment itself demonstrated this lesson. The students involved in the protest refused to be cast as the child, capital C, in a national fantasy. Camped out on the campus, they instead occupied that fantasy, offered a panicked, irrationally terrified future of security for some, they courageously demanded a future of freedom for all. By occupying the physical space of the campus, students are de-schooling in the sense of taking back their education and recreating it as collective power, while also demanding the transformation of school in concrete political terms. Both parts, free school and blockade, the encampment reflects the revolutionary strategies essential to de-schooling society. As this movement of encampments grew in the spring of 2024, campus panic has grown with it. The fight against this panic is a struggle not only against the ideological fantasy space of campus, but against the hatred of students. Quote, the anti-student imaginary is full of massacres that aren't happening rather than the ones that are, scholar Daniel Spalding quips. In his essay on hating students, Spalding elaborates on the revenge fantasy at the heart of campus panic. Quote, arrogant snowflakes meet the real world, where facts don't care about your feelings. Would-be radicals get job offers rescinded. Would-be gender theorists get their dignity stripped in low-paying service jobs. To this, he suggests that the student is defined by, quote, susceptibility to discipline. Quote, a student is a person to whom an expanded range of disciplinary procedures can be applied, since they are at the mercy of multiple sovereignties. Thus, students can be simultaneously arrested by the NYPD, evicted from their homes, and suspended from academic programs. And in Gaza, they are being killed. Among academic workers, what has been politicizing for us as non-students, who are nevertheless targets of this revenge fantasy ourselves, has come from collectively witnessing this hatred of students as a structural condition of schooling, rather than as a mere exception playing out right now. We receive countless emails about threats to campus safety. I got a bunch today about a strike. It's unsafe. From the same campus administrators who oversee police violence against hundreds of students, resulting in arrests, hospitalizations, and inestimable harm. We are told that our job is to support our students, but to keep our jobs, we are asked to betray them. However we position ourselves as individuals, we are acting within a system that disregards and in some cases seems to outright hate its students. Throughout these recent struggles, some of the most politically galvanizing moments have come from students and teachers working together against the repression of university administrations. Never before have I witnessed such a show of student-teacher solidarity. Among the many who, like myself, have spent their lives as students and academic workers, perhaps something like a glimpse into a de-schooling society emerged on April 22nd, 2024, when dozens of faculty linked arms and formed a line around protesting students after their employer, New York University, ordered the NYPD to raid the Free Gaza encampment in Gould Plaza, a block away from Washington Square Park. Days later, faculty at the City University of New York created a picket around their encampment as well. And they chanted, to get our students, you'll have to get through us. And days after that, the first faculty solidarity encampment was formed blocks away at the new school, which called on faculty across all campuses to escalate and take greater coordinated risk and solidarity with the student movements, their demands, and the people of Palestine and their righteous struggle. Most of us have taken part in the struggle in the student encampment, offering teach-ins, helping with resources, and just hanging out, as my friend Natasha Leonard, who teaches at the new school, explains to me. We wanted to act in solidarity. Soon after the faculty encampment was established, students, and faculty, and other supporters moved to take over the entire university building together. These moments of student-teacher solidarity help us to imagine education in revolutionary terms. And this involves confronting the trouble with school, not by opting out of it, as in the libertarian impulse of unschooling, but by remaking school in order to remake the world. In his vision of revolutionary education, Belgian author and former Situationist Raoul Vanhem calls for students and teachers to come together to form collectives tasked with, quote, snatching the school from the glaciation of profit and changing it to a place of simple human generosity. As in Illich's call to disestablish school, Vanhem makes a compelling case to take back the schools as the basis for a revolution. Quote, occupy your school. Don't let them appropriate you from their programmed dilapidation. Transform the schools into creative workshops, into meeting places, into parks of attractive intelligence. Unquote. While the encampments reflect this transformation, part of their power comes from a shared practice of critical negation. Inasmuch as the encampments illuminate aspects of a revolutionary pedagogy, they also expose the ways that educational institutions are not designed to educate, forcing their contradictions to the surface. Inspired by the Free Gaza encampments, Trans Kids Deserve Better, a group of youth activists in the UK, began to experiment with these tactics during the summer of 2024. In August, they occupied the Department of Education in London with a series of demands to improve trans youth conditions of safety and learning in schools, while facing governmental bans on puberty blockers and access to gender-affirming care. Quote, I'm out here because I want school to be safe, one of the youth activists explained. I have never felt safe at school as a trans person. And by taking autonomous action, they were showing adults how to show up for them, beyond the idea of protecting trans kids. Quote, the adult supporters who've been around have been supporting us how we need, and that is, to me, a representation of how the wider movement around trans youth liberation should be, as one protester put it. Trans youth organizing themselves and calling the shots and taking these matters into our own hands. For youth and adults alike, what these occupations and encampments created were zones of contact with school and the world could be, if only we try for it. And to try, we have to practice what schooling makes impossible, solidarity. Thank you.
Well, so now we're gonna have a conversation. I forgot to say who I am. I'm Gonzalo Bustamante Moyan. I'm a PhD student in the philosophy and the GSS departments here. Very happy to see all of you here. And I, when we organized this event, I wanted to have a conversation and invite some of my teachers to join me and meet Madeline as well. So we were very graced by Professor Kamisha Russell. Say yes, Professor Russell, anyone who knows her knows how amazing she is, right? Exactly.
I commanded her there.
Yeah. But in addition to being one of my favorite people that I've met in this department, along with Melody, she's also an associate professor of philosophy here and has written, to my view, one of the best accounts of the assisted reproduction of race, one of the best accounts of the relationship and political importance of understanding race and reproduction together. Absolutely brilliant book. So after this one, you can also read Misha's book. And then also my friend, Melody Allison, who's a student as well, here, a PhD student in the philosophy department, but also in the environmental studies department. Besides being also an amazing person, she has multiple talents and can do podcasts and many things that no academic knows how to do. So we're always very grateful for that. And they're also mothering in many different ways. So I'm very glad to have them in conversation with us today. So welcome, Melody, and welcome, Professor Kamisha Russell. Does anyone want to start? We'll have a small conversation and then open it up.
So many possible entry points. Just, I guess, to connect a little bit with some of the work that I've done, it reminds me of, I guess it makes you think about when people are doing assisted reproductive technologies, when they're like seeking donors, for example, like a sperm donor or an egg donor, and they're like looking at websites, right, and they're sort of getting lists of characteristics, some are physical characteristics, some of which, many of which, the genetic transmission of are much more complicated than is let on, but also a lot of hobbies and the job of the donor, the hobby of the donor, the likes and dislikes, those kinds of things. And so it really, I feel like it creates a sense very early on, right, that you can, choose your child in a particular, that you can sort of, it's not, I don't think it's intended in an unloving way or something like that, but it is a very early beginning to sort of expectations, I think, about who your child would be. So, similarly, gender selection, right, is an expectation about how girls are, how boys are, and so if you make this selection, you're going to get this kind of child, right? Just to sort of say, I think that this idea of child ownership, right, kind of is cultivated really early on in this kind of pre-birth way with reproductive technologies, and the way that the marketing that's done around these sort of give a sense that as if they're sort of handing you a sort of list of potential genetic traits of your child, even when the traits are manifestly non-genetic, let alone the ones that are much more complicated than they seem. So that's just another, that's one way I see our sort of my past work and your work connecting.
Thank you. I've been thinking a lot about that in relation to the relationship between parenting and teaching also, right? The fantasy that what we're doing as teachers is molding young minds, right? But that's also, a lot of parenting culture is really based in that idea that based in this Enlightenment thinking from John Locke, that a child is a blank slate, right? And so all of the things that we're doing with children is reflecting back to us, our own virtues, our own politics, and these type of things, right? And these are fantasies that are not just right-wing fantasies about children, right? Obviously, it's very much at work in groomer panic, right, that children are being groomed, but that same logic is happening even among the most well-intentioned parents, caretakers, teachers, that we actually are the agents of our children, right? And it's a bit, I think that's part of what I'm bumping against in terms of the thinkability, right, of child liberation, right, is how do we critically reflect and unpack those things that are basically unconscious, handed down to us, what our responsibility as parents are. And it does definitely, gestating, you're constantly being told, you put something into your body and it's going to do this thing to the fetus and things like that. But that really does apply to all sorts of things, including... Yeah, even how we're running a seminar among adults, right? Adult students. So, yeah, I appreciate that.
Yes, there were so many things that I wanted to respond to, but I think the one that really that I've been struggling with since coming to the U of O was this naive desire that I worked for 10 years between my master's and my PhD, and I thought, oh, I'm sick of capitalism, I'm going to escape into this university. And then I got here and I was like, oh shit.
Nike Town.
Yeah. Well, I definitely was surprised by that. And I think you outlined this tension that that I've been thinking about a lot, which is that I think school has so much potential for liberation, for solidarity, for part of what we're doing is trying to inspire different ways of thinking and creativity. And then there's the administrative component and the structure of it. And so I think there's always gonna be kind of a tension between it, but I was wondering if you would speak more about how you're navigating that tension as a professor. You said at two different universities, adjunct. Yes, of course. They would like to give you this very your titles are very important, so that so everybody knows what status they are, and the children are beneath you and somebody's above you, and that's all part of this the undermining structure of I think what we're trying to do, which is maybe cultivate people and bring out their talents. Mm-hmm. But I find that struggle every day. And yeah. Then being a student and a teacher as a PhD, I'm playing both roles right now.
Absolutely. Well, the short answer is to just find every way possible to sabotage the administration. And it's nice to be an adjunct in that sense, because they don't care about me. So, a lot less pressure to do any management. But I appreciate what you're saying. That's part of why I'm still in the university system. I think that it's not like there's a better thing to be doing, I think. There's a lot of great reasons why people are drawn to universities. And there's the reality of how universities actually work. And so negotiating between those things has to happen at the ground level. But I begin that chapter thinking a lot about, like, what do we desire from school? And that desire has nothing to do with the reality of school, but it's very helpful. And that can be a revolutionary weapon. We're all here because we want to think and learn and talk and work through ideas, and there are limited spaces to do that in this world. So beginning with that, and I do appreciate this idea that I was reading from Rel Vanaham, that that schools are a good place to start for revolution. That is the institution to take hold of, and that we actually outnumber those administrators.
Like,
there are more of us, and
so
we have power.
They're working on.
They are. You're right. If you looked at the dollars, I know. But that insight is I think it's a place to start. It's not the only place to start, but it is a place to start. And I've had I draw a lot from my own experiences. My partner and I met occupying a university building, and that was a couple years before Occupy Wall Street. And I remember thinking, like, what we're doing in this university building feels kind of silly, and it's probably not going to be effective. But you actually don't know when these encampments that were popping up. I mean, people are going to carry that forward and bring that to the next thing. And there's a lot of great experimentation that we can be doing at schools. But that does really require us to know what schools actually are, right? And to be, putting ourselves into direct conflict with that at any moment we can. And that's sometimes really exhausting, right? Because institutions function through exhaustion. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
I don't know if I probably just partially answered in a few directions, but I appreciate the question.
Maybe something that connects with that. Also, you can take one of our seats. Yes. We're just sitting up here until the end. Like, so we're not going back to those chairs at all. So you should sit
there's
down.
We can clear the babies as well.
Yes.
there's a baby free inside. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah,
I'm making you uncomfortable in my effort to make you more comfortable. Which I think is also maybe what I do with my child. Don't you want this sweatshirt? No, I don't want this sweatshirt. Are you sure? You look really cool. So I'm thinking when you were talking about the sort of fantasy of campus, I was thinking about how campuses are this sort of like almost mono-generational space, or if you sort of count the faculty as sort of a vague older generation, but you know, like, but only one aspect of the faculty, right? A professional capacity, not the faculty as, say, you know, in their 30s or middle aged or, you know, near retirement, but just sort of as their faculty teaching. I feel like there's something very appealing maybe about leaving your house and going to this like space where everyone is young and you're on your own for the first time. But I feel like there's also something extremely and dangerously artificial about a place that consists primarily of, say, 18 to 23-year-olds or so, right? I mean, you know, obviously, there's older students and so on and so forth. But you know, like dorms, too. Like, God forbid, fraternities and sororities. These spaces where there's been a lot, just speaking of campus safety, there's been a lot of hazing emails, warnings about hazing emails recently. Is that on my mind? But I think, you know, like what would a learning environment look like if there were more kids around? Like, I mean, this is obviously a very unusual moment, right, in a classroom, right, like this many young children. Or if there were more like elderly people around, you know, like what would it be like to learn and also be connected with people who are both older and younger, whether they were learning in the same format, at the same place or not? And you know, and I've taught a few different places. One of them was at the University of Memphis, which was much less well-funded school in a poorer city as well. And one of the nice things, there are many nice things about it. One of the nice things about it was how most students were not living isolated lives in campus dorms. Most students were living at home, or maybe were married, or maybe had kids, or you know. Or were you know, playing a part in caring for elders, or they were genuinely in an everyday sense connected with other people, or they were working like jobs too. But you know, and so you know, some of the best moments sort of talking to students would be when they would say, you know, oh, well, I was talking to my grandma the other day, and I was telling her about this thing you said in class, and she was telling me about this thing she experienced, right? And sort of seeing those connections being made, or this wonderful woman who apparently was like fighting with her husband about racism during the whole class. Like he was like really kind of committed to it, and she was kind of like, "No, this is wrong." I was like, "Wow, man, I can't even imagine like just going home every day and being like, you know what though, you're wrong." So I guess I'm just sort of thinking about how campus spaces can be really even if students. In some sense, how they can still be kind of these spots where you, where you're like temporarily and artificially free, or at least some of them, right? This all depends on privilege, of course. But like, you know, temporarily and artificially free of other kinds of concerns or forms of care, or you know, and you're just supposed to like maybe figure out how to do your laundry and you know not drink so much that you get like injured or whatever. Like, I mean, you know, sort of seems to be the. And then went to Penn State, and that was a little more like that one. You know, so Memphis was more connected and grounded in things, and Penn State was really like, we're this college, we're this huge university that's as big as the rest of the town. But, like, you know, we double the town when we're here, and like, we can just kind of do what we want.
Right.
Like, so anyway, I don't know how that kind of all fits in, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, it's not unique to college campuses either, right? The way that schools are set up, the idea that you're supposed to just take classes forever with somebody who was born within the same 12 months as you, right? It really, like, from the get-go prevents any kind of rubric for intergenerational, I mean, generations then being like 1 year, right? Like, being able to just talk to anyone who's not your age, right? And so that is a huge part of how the schooling system works. It's hard to figure out. I'm teaching a class right now that got cross-listed. The administration didn't tell me about it, which was really cool of them. Of undergraduates and graduate students. And nobody knew that this was happening. And then the first day, there were like 18-year-olds, it's their first day of college. And then I have graduate students, it's their last year of their master's program. And I've been trying really hard to figure out how to create a good dynamic among them, but they don't want to have, the graduate students look down on the undergraduates, and the undergraduates are scared of the graduates. And I don't know how to, I talk to all of them individually, but it's really hard to socially engineer this seminar space. But I think it speaks to this, like, how bizarre it is that one is to take in a class where people are coming at it from different, whatever, levels. The language we have for these things are also so revealing, right, of the hierarchical system. But yeah, it's really challenging as an educator. But they also benefit so much from being in a space together, and they can't, it's really hard to clarify that. And I don't mean to be hating on my students. I think I would be frustrated as well by the administration.
You could use some more.
Well, and you mentioned, I mean, of course, I think the encampment was a little, like, of course, that space of rupture. I also find that in this campus, we've had a lot of thought, heard, peace, at least momentarily, be at least suspended or interrupted through a lot of labor activity that we've had in solidarity amongst us. So, like, the faculty almost went on strike last year. And, for example, I was along Tamisha, right, in a picket line, right? And in that sense, as co-workers, right, like, as workers, so trying to find those spaces, I think, has been very revealing to me of, like, breaking the hierarchies. And I didn't mention it, but, for example, Melody is the co-chair of the parent caucus in our union, so very important to have that.
You've been listening to Madeline Lane McKinney on her book Solidarity with Children on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. More next week, and the Q&A next week, and a little bit of my take on it. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. I'm on this ride with you, okay? I'm not saying I know anything about family abolition. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media.
I tell you that my song is really true. I want everyone to listen and believe. It's about some little people from a long time ago, and all the things the neighbors didn't know. Early in the morning, Daddy Dinky went to work, selling lamps and chairs to San Bernardino Squares. And I still remember Mama with her apron and her pad, feeding all the boys at its cafe, whizzing and pasting and pooting through the day, Ronnie helping Kenny, helping burn his boots away. And all the while on a shelf in the shed, Kenny's little creatures on display. Ronnie saves his numies on a window in his room, a marvel to be seen, dysentery green, while Kenny and his buddies had a game out in the back, let's make the water turn black. We see them after school in a world of their own. To some it might seem creepy what they do. The neighbors on the right sat and watched them every night. I'll bet you'd do the same if they was you. Whizzing and pasting and pooting through the day, Ronnie helping Kenny, helping burn his boots away. And all the while on a shelf in the shed, Kenny's little creatures on display. Ronnie's in the army now and Kenny's taking pills. Oh, how they yearn to see a bomber burn. Color flashing, thunder crashing, dynamite machine. Wait till the fire turns green. Wait till the fire turns green. Wait till the fire turns green.
This would be a little bit of vocal teenage heaven right here on Earth.
Right, 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 right.